I'm John Kroll. We have a special No Limits today. We're airing live from NPR's beautiful studios in Washington, D.C. for the first of two shows from here. Today we're going to talk about what we can expect from this new Congress and this new administration, with a particular focus on issues of importance to Indiana. My guests are longtime Republican political strategist Cam Savage, longtime Democratic political strategist Ben Ray, and Jacob Rund of CQ Roll Call. We won't be taking calls today, but we'd love to have you join the conversation by email at nolimits@wfyi.org or on social media at WFYI. Now, this news. Welcome to No Limits. I am John Kroll, director of Franklin College's Pulliam School of Journalism, publisher of the StateHouseFile.com, and your host. We're going to be talking about this new political world that we are venturing into. This is a special No Limits. We are broadcasting live from the beautiful NPR studios in Washington, D.C. Before we get into the program, I need to say thank you to Emily Dagger and her superb team here at NPR for making us feel so welcome. My guests are Cam Savage. He is a longtime Republican political strategist, Ben Ray, who is a longtime Democratic political strategist, and Jacob Rund, who is with CQ Roll Call. And I should do a disclosure. Jacob's also a former student of mine. Welcome to all of you.
Thanks.
Thank you.
It's good to have you all here. And I should say Happy New Year to everyone as well, since we are in a new year. So let's start big on this. We're seeing something that we have not seen now for more than a decade, and that is having both the White House, or the executive branch and the legislative branch, in controlled by the same party. What sorts of changes are we likely to see, and what are some of the consequences, the opportunities that that Hoosiers might see from them? I'll start with you, Cam.
Sure. Well, today's the first day of the new Congress. It's one of my favorite days of the year because everyone's full of hope and optimism, particularly good if you're a Republican. The idea that we'd have a Republican Senate still and a pretty robust majority in the House is not something a lot of people predicted even a few months ago. So there is a big agenda. And you know, I think with President Trump being inaugurated in a few days, he's going to have a full-throated agenda that sometimes may differ from the agenda of the Republicans in Congress. You know, Speaker Ryan obviously has campaigned this year on his Better Way agenda. They want to tackle big issues like tax reform and entitlements. President-elect has said he wants to do some of those things as well. Those are really big problems to try to get into and try to fix. And I think the real interesting thing in Washington is going to be trying to see if we can determine just how different those ideas will be coming from the president-elect and coming from Mitch McConnell and Paul Ryan.
Ben, I'm going to give you the next word here because you're obviously going to be looking at this from the other end of the lens.
I think there's, you know, an important partisan dynamic. There's also an important bipartisan dynamic coming up in this new Congress. You know, I think you look at the partisan one, and the Republican Party has for some years had the luxury of not having the White House, you know, until after the 2014 midterms. It did not have control of the Senate. And so now we're finding out the ideas that were run on, the votes that were held, what are they actually going to do when it's their responsibility? And I think you look at the divisions in their party over Obamacare right now. And it's significant. I think to some degree they're the dog that caught the car. Are they going to repeal it and then say we're going to replace it in 3 years and set up some sort of a healthcare cliff? Are they going to be able to come up with a plan to keep coverage in place for the millions of Americans that got their care from the ACA? You know, frankly, they've been operating in this political, non-policy related space for several years. You know, and I think seeing those chickens come home to roost is going to be very interesting. But that's a partisan fight. I'm also interested to see, the bipartisan dynamic, as Cam alluded to. The president-elect and the new Congress are probably frequently not going to be on the same page. And I think the first big hurdle when it comes to that is when you look at the sanctions that the outgoing administration has announced on Russia, where you see Republicans like John McCain, like Lindsey Graham, telling their party that this is not a partisan issue, that they need to work with Democrats to hold Russia accountable for meddling in our election. Frankly, there are a lot of members of the House that come from strong Donald Trump districts, and whether or not they're willing to put their country and our national security above their own better political concerns, I think that's going to be a real interesting question, and I think we can't quite say how to answer it yet.
Jacob, what do you expect? I'll reframe the second part of that. How do you think a lot of what's going to be coming out of here will affect people in Indiana?
Well, for Hoosiers, it's interesting because for the first time since Dan Quayle, there's a Hoosier vice president. And what's going to be interesting to see is how he acts as the liaison to Congress, which many expect him to do. He is planning a meeting. He will be on the Hill, actually, on Wednesday, speaking with congressional leaders about the Republicans' plan to repeal and replace Obamacare or the Affordable Care Act. And that's going to be an interesting dynamic to see. A lot of people will be following that closely. Obviously, President-elect Donald Trump doesn't have any legislative experience. Mike Pence, he's a six-term congressman, knows a lot of the key individuals, and it's looking like he's definitely going to be on the Hill a lot. And he's actually been on the record telling House Republican leaders to get ready and gear up, that they're going to be working a lot more this cycle.
We've gotten an email question from a listener, and I'd like to remind our audience that we're not taking calls today, but we are taking questions via email. You can find us at nolimits@wfyi.org or on social media on Facebook at nolimitswfyi, on Twitter at wfyi. Our regular listener Jerry writes, "It seems unlikely that the newly convening legislature will accomplish much over the next 4 years. However, the federal judiciary is positioned to make radical and enduring changes to fundamental aspects of our constitutional republic. If Mr. Trump indeed appoints the kind of judges he has named, please ask your panelists which of the following disastrous consequences are likeliest to occur. 1, effectively overturning Roe versus Wade. 2, strengthening the ability of religious zealots actively to discriminate against citizens whose religious beliefs are not mainstream, especially Muslims and many LGBT people. Removing the ability of local communities to enact reasonable firearms regulations for their municipalities. And then 4, further favoring big money interests, suppression of unions, environmental regulation, patent copyright issues, or the ability to file class action lawsuits." We're going to take the spirit of Jerry's question here. And I'll throw, I think that one's aimed more your way, Cam.
Sure.
But I'll let Ben have a whack at it. He really asked which of these is the most likely, which is another way of asking what's going to be, of any of these, which is going to be a priority.
Well, Jerry's absolutely right about the fact that the Supreme Court choice of Donald Trump is going to suck a lot of oxygen out of the debate in the coming months. I mean, that's going to be a very big deal. I don't think it's likely that anyone is confirmed before the term ends in June, so this is not something that I would expect has to be done soon, or an appointment that has to be made soon, or even one a process that will happen quickly. But it's going to be a very big deal. More bad news for Jerry: there are about 100 judicial vacancies around the country right now. Mm-hmm. So it's not just the Supreme Court choice that the president-elect is going to be making sometime in the near future. It will get most of the attention, but there are about 100 other judicial openings right now across the country at the district court and the circuit court level that are, to Jerry's point, are a big deal. And those will go a long way towards shaping policies across the country as well. So, I think that'll be a very big deal when that announcement is made. That is likely to be the number one topic in Washington for a a period of time in the coming year.
Do we expect, basically appointments over the Supreme Court and judicial appointments in general have been for at least a generation and a half, two generations, the occasion for battles royal in Congress. Do we anticipate that that's going to be the case with this administration and this Congress? In part because we've seen you don't necessarily have to be in the majority to, to put a stick in the spokes and jam things up, Ben.
No, I would expect very tough confirmation fights. Looking beyond even just the judiciary and the Supreme Court vacancy, the lower court vacancies, those are going to be a big deal. I think you're going to see an increased push from Senate Democrats to vet and hold accountable, the president's cabinet appointees. It's been rumored, I don't know if reported is the right word, but rumored that the Trump vetting operation is not at the top of their game. And I think that, you'll see Senate Democrats apply themselves to make sure that the American people are aware of who's going to be in President-elect Trump's cabinet. I think you look at Tom Price has said some very problematic things about Medicare. Obviously, there's been a lot of ink spilled over Rex Tillerson's ties to Russia. And I think you're going to see Senate Democrats working to make sure that our voters are informed about who's going to be in the government and who's going to be helping the president-elect exercise the levers of power.
It is interesting, though, because, just a few years ago, the Senate Democrats, when they were in the majority, changed the rules to make it easier to confirm some of these lower-level judges and some of these other appointments. Now, that didn't change for the 60-vote threshold for the Supreme Court nominations, but they've essentially made it easier for Republicans to put people on the federal court and also in some of these other administrative positions.
Which is proof that, some of the changes that you like when you are in power are not necessarily changes you ought to implement because they can come back to bite you. Jacob, is there any hope that at some point we're going to be able to get along again and function as one government, one society? Because we hear a lot of the talk, and it's not just from Cam and Ben, but elsewhere, is that this is a very divided nation. We're looking at a pretty divided government. We're going to have a lot of battles. We've had a lot of battles already.
Right. And I'm not sure that those battles will cease, at least, in the beginning of President-elect Trump's administration. It's looking like there will be a lot more fights to come. I think Ben is right that the his Supreme Court nomination is going to be a key point for both sides, for both parties. I think that's going to be one of the biggest fights that we see. Another fight, and probably first and foremost, will be repealing and replacing Republicans' efforts to repeal and replace the Affordable Care Act. Pence has said that the administration will try and repeal it lock, stock, and barrel. I think that's going to be the first big fight that we see. As far as the actual administration goes, I anticipate there will be a little bit of a rocky start, but there should be some cohesiveness just based on who Trump has picked so far for his cabinet. I think, he's handpicked these people because he knows he gets along with them, he works with them. So I think it could actually go either way, but we'll just have to wait and see.
I'm going to throw this to both Ben and Cam. We focused, and to some degree we've already alluded to the fact that that President-elect Trump and the Republican leadership in Congress don't always seem to be on the same page. Is that a fair criticism, though? Because it struck me as someone who's been covering politics for way too many years that almost every president ends up having some trouble with the leadership in his own party in Congress. Are we paying more attention to it this time because it's Donald Trump? Cam?
I would say almost certainly we are. Part of that has to do with the fact that the president-elect's philosophical views on a number of issues have changed over the course of the campaign. He was a Democrat up until not that long ago, and he has a set of beliefs on trade and some other issues that are just very divergent from the mainstream Republican thought over the last few generations. And, how that works itself out is one of the great questions. I follow this as closely as anyone. I have no trouble telling you. I have no idea what's going to happen in a Trump presidency.
Ben, I'm going to give you about 30 seconds.
Sure. I mean, I'm like Cam. I don't know what's going to happen, but I do think that we're paying more attention to this now because of the norms that Donald Trump is violating. You know, traditionally, we can sit here and fight all we want in Washington and say all the nasty things we want in Washington, but politics has stopped at the water's edge. And that standard has been slowly degrading, and I think you look no further than the incoming administration's strenuous defense of the Russia hack to see why this is different and why we're paying more attention to it now.
We are talking politics here on No Limits. We're live from NPR studios in Washington, D.C. My guests are longtime Republican strategist Cam Savage, longtime Democratic political strategist Ben Ray, and Jacob Rund of CQ Roll Call. We're not taking calls, but you can find us via email or social media here on No Limits. I'm John Kroll. You're listening to No Limits. Please stay with us. Welcome back to No Limits. I am John Kroll, director of Franklin College's Pulliam School of Journalism, publisher of the StateHouseFile.com, and your host. We're talking about politics in this year of 2017. We're broadcasting live from NPR's beautiful studios here in Washington, D.C. We're not taking calls today, but if you want to join the conversation, you can send us an email at nolimits@wfyi.org. You can find us on Facebook at nolimitswfyi. Or track us down on Twitter at WFYI. My guests are Cam Savage. He is a longtime Republican political strategist. Ben Ray, who is a longtime Democratic political strategist. And Jacob Rund, who is with CQ Roll Call. We've gotten an email from a listener who did not want to be identified, who asks, in what some now call the post-fact era, how can we hold anyone accountable in this new Congress, Senate, or executive branch? Jacob, I'm going to throw that one to you because it's got particular implications for those of us who are journalists.
Sure, and I'm going to attack this from the journalist perspective. You know, in our industry, really, all you can do is fact check. You need to assume that everything that is said, you know, there might be some truth to it, there might not be, and it's our responsibility to dig and see where that truth is. So that's really first and foremost. I think all we can really do is just keep fact-checking and make sure that people are saying what is true, and when they don't say what is true, make sure that we call them out on it. And that's really really the only thing I can see, you know, that we can get past this. And we saw this with the past election and with several other elections, you know, that a lot of people are trying to pass off things that aren't necessarily true. And oftentimes the public will believe it. So it's our responsibility as journalists to make sure that we identify what is and what isn't true.
Ben, I'm going to go to you first on this, but I'm going to give Cam a shot at it as well. How much of this is also a product of the fact that, let's face it, elected officials and even political candidates don't need the mainstream media quite as much as they did a generation ago? You don't need a newspaper or a TV to connect with your constituency. There are just so many other ways through social media, all these other ways to connect with people. How much of this is that, this dynamic of the post-fact era, a product of that?
I think this fact-free era that we seem to be in, the fake news, the propaganda problem that we see on social media, you know, that really is the symptom. But what you're describing, that's the sickness. That's the underlying illness. And I think that's what we have to learn how to fix, is that, you know, everybody's got their own news station that, you know, if you're a political partisan leading your own life, you know, identify as a Republican or Democrat out in the States, and you only want to get news that reinforces your worldview, it's here for you. You know, and the flip side of that is for public officials, if they want to go someplace and not be challenged, well, then that outlet is there for them too. And, you know, I think since the election, you know, a lot of Democrats, a lot of folks that I talk to, reacting with almost this shock that, you know, it was this bad, that, you know, we had allowed it to happen. And I think a little bit of that shock came from, obviously, we all expected to win, right? Mm-hmm. And then not winning, we're looking for what do we point at? What's at fault? What's the issue? You know, and I think we've got an opportunity to channel that anxiety into something that is actually important to the civic good of this country, which is getting outside of your ideological silos. Mm-hmm. And I've actually got some, you know, some good hope for that in the new Congress, because when you look at the moderate Senate Democrats that are coming into leadership, you know, you've got obviously a Senate minority leader who has not hesitated to make deals in the past. You've got Debbie Stabenow in leadership. You've got Joe Manchin in leadership. And I think you're going to see a more concentrated effort from our party to make sure that we're talking to everybody, to make sure that we're reaching out, you know, that we're not writing off whole swaths of the electorate. You know, and I think, frankly, you saw that. I think you saw a party get caught inside its own silo. The irony is that everybody thought that was happening to the Republicans in the last election, and it turns out it was happening to us.
Cam.
Yeah, look, I'm actually quite distressed about this as a Republican. I know that most of the dialogue on this issue, the fake news issue, has mostly been Democrats lamenting it. They feel that Hillary Clinton was treated in a way that's unfair. I can just tell you that it certainly happens on our side of the aisle as well. It's something that, you know, I'm quite concerned about and have been for some time. You know, I think it's the best case I've heard, and I'm eager for my Democrat friends to join the chorus for some real education reform in this country. I mean, we're essentially saying that people are not smart enough to determine what is real news and what is fake news. It's the best call I've heard for some real substantial education reform, and maybe that's a way we could all come to agree on this. At the same time, some of the best reporting in the Indiana election this last cycle, particularly the Senate race, came from the Indianapolis Star and the Associated Press Bureau in Indianapolis. Mm-hmm. And so some of the, you know, and I think reporting by those outlets actually made a difference in that race. So as we talk about fake news, I think we also ought to, you know, remember that there is actually journalism happening in Indiana and Indianapolis that is actually making a difference in our politics and, you know, hopefully in the governance of the state and the nation.
If you're just joining us, we are talking politics in this year 2017 from beautiful studios in NPR's beautiful studios in Washington, D.C. We're not taking calls during this broadcast, but if you want to join the conversation, you can send us an email at nolimits@wfyi.org. You can find us on Facebook at nolimitswfyi, or you can track us down on Twitter at wfyi. Well, the flip side of that, though, and part of the reason that we have seen the emergence of people relying more on social media is that they said, and we still hear that complaint, that, you know, the mainstream traditional media apply a filter that is not necessarily fair. And, you know, you both sort of alluded to the fact that you know, Democrats feel that Hillary Clinton wasn't treated fairly. Donald Trump's made it very clear many times that he didn't think he was treated fairly. And I've heard these kinds of complaints. How much of this is a product of that, and what should then reporters do to, you know, regenerate that trust? I'll start with Cam on that one, but I want to hear everyone's thoughts.
Yeah, I mean, look, as a Republican operator and operative who deals with the media on a daily basis, you know, I would tell you that do I believe that there's an intrinsic bias by a lot of reporters out there? I do. I mean, I know that philosophically reporters don't see eye to eye, don't see the world the way that I do. I don't let that get in the way of me doing my job, and I hope they don't let that get in the way of them doing their job. And really, it means that I have to have relationships, you know, with the reporters, the people covering the campaigns and the candidates and the office holders that I care about. And, you know, my philosophy is, and maybe it's because I have a journalism degree, but my philosophy is that, you know,
from my alma mater, I probably
that's absolutely from Franklin College, that, you know, that I believe you have to, you know, have that open dialogue constantly and work with people. And, you know, when I get a bad story, you know, if somebody writes a story that I don't agree with, I don't call up and yell at that person. I don't call and chew that reporter out. You know, I let it slide 99% of the time. If I have a real beef, I'll say, you know, I think you're wrong about this and here's why, but I do it in a respectful way. And, you know, I find that just works better. And what we're looking for is an understanding between the candidates and the campaigns and the journalists who cover them. And, you know, it's difficult at times, but the good reporters understand that too. And they'll work to make, they'll work with you to try to, you know, achieve that sort of balance and fairness, in my view.
Ben.
Yeah, you know, I think, look, there is a slight bias in political journalism, and I don't think it's to the left or to the right. It's to conflict. You know, we saw Donald Trump tweet this morning that he thought that perhaps House Republicans would be better served to not keep the Office of Congressional Ethics, just to get rid of it at a different time. You know, they seem to be following his advice, and I guess Donald Trump is, if nothing else, an expert on optics. But that was reported heavily as, you know, Trump torches House GOP. Trump goes after House Republicans. And, you know, look, I'm sure the president-elect is going to claim that as a win, but that's not what he was doing. He was saying, not now, guys. Do it when nobody's watching. And so I think there's, it's important to understand that. But writ large, and, you know, look, I've been the flack complaining about biased coverage before. I think we all have. You know, it's important that, frankly, as political candidates, maybe I can say this better now that we're out of an election cycle. You know, it's important for us to embrace the need of journalists to investigate, to dig, to run down rumors, to get their hands on things. You know, I don't know any responsible journalist, right, left, you name it, that doesn't get in touch, even if it's just with a few minutes, to say, hey, I'm going to run a story on X, or I'm looking into Y. What do you think? Am I missing something? What am I getting wrong? Is there a mitigating fact? You know, and that's how this has to play out for us to have a, you know, a functioning republic, is that the journalist will do the vetting, you know, the public office holders, the people in power, will defend or explain themselves, and then it's up to the public to grade that out. So I think look from the political class to the journalist, I think the answer has to be come at us and we'll try to do better next time, right?
Jacob, do you run into that that question of trust when you're doing your work now?
Sure. I think there is now, possibly more than ever, this ingrained sense of distrust of the media. I definitely encounter this doing my work. People are very skeptical, you know, approaching people on the Hill, staffers, whomever it may be. Everyone is skeptical and everyone wants to have their voice heard, which makes for an interesting dynamic. But I think Cam and Ben pretty much covered this, but I will say this. I think it's important that, you know, every journalist give a story its due diligence. I think for readers, it's important for them to identify, you know, where that story is coming from and whether or not, you know, both sides are represented within that story, who's quoted and things of that nature. So it really comes down to just good, solid investigative reporting. And that's, you know, that's where the truth is going to come from.
Got an email question from a listener named Allie. And again, if you want to reach out to us by email, you can find us at nolimits@wfyi.org. Allie writes, I would appreciate a blunt discussion from your panel regarding President-elect Trump's true understanding of basic government workings, foreign policy, and the actual role of the president. Does he have the knowledge and wisdom to make difficult decisions, think critically, and act quickly with a level head? I am fearful that he will not be able to handle the immense pressure of this position and its effect not only on Americans, but the entire world. I know that there's obviously, we can assume here that obviously Allie was not a Trump voter, but
well, he's had a rough fall if she was, if he's lost her already.
Yeah, but, to be fair, there is more anxiety about this transition than any I have seen, you know, in 30 plus years of covering politics. What things do you think, Cam, and I guess if you were advising President-elect Trump, what would you be advising him to do to deal with those kinds of concerns?
Well, you know, I'm not advising him. I certainly understand you know, the way people feel about this. I would have great concerns if we were getting ready to swear Hillary Clinton into office as president. So I certainly understand that people, you know, feel this way. You know, I would definitely tell the president-elect to lay off Twitter. So, of course, he's mastered the art of tweeting. He certainly knows how to get attention. But I think it's some of those things are a little bit, you know, beneath what I want in a president. That would be the first thing I would do. That said, I mean, I think overall, I look at the people he's chosen for the cabinet so far, and I give the president-elect pretty good marks. I think there's some people there that are certainly competent and capable. As Jacob said earlier, you know, our own governor, Mike Pence, is set to be vice president in just a few days, very likely to be the most powerful vice president in our lifetime. That was a description that people gave to Dick Cheney just a few years ago. And from my read of the situation, Mike Pence is certainly going to be much more influential in this administration than Cheney was even in the Bush administration. Part of that has to do with the fact that he's heavily involved in the transition and placing people in government at the layer just below the secretary level. Those are the people that actually run the government. You know, the deputies and all these cabinet agencies are the ones that actually run the federal government. And so, you know, I think we're seeing an unprecedented level of influence from Mike Pence. So by spreading that around, I think the president-elect has made some good picks for the cabinet so far. I think people ought to give him a time. There is something fundamentally American about giving the guy a shot, right? I mean, I certainly, you know, was not, you know, when President Obama was elected, there were some who you know, were in opposition to him pretty quickly. But there were a lot of us who said, you know, we need, you know, as Americans, we ought to come together and we ought to see how the guy does for a while. And I think there is something fundamentally American about that. So I would say to Ali, give the guy a chance. Let's see what he does. He's been surprising before. No one thought he could win the Republican nomination. I did not think he could win the Republican nomination. I did not think he could win the election. He did. So let's the guy's earned the chance for a shot. We should give him one.
Ben, and I'll say it so that you don't have to. I know it's an article of faith among Democrats is that Republicans did not give Barack Obama a chance. I mean, are we seeing this? Is this going to be the cycle going forward, that the idea of a political honeymoon is just a thing of the past with presidents?
I think presidents to some degree make their own honeymoon. Barack Obama was incredibly popular when he took office, and Donald Trump is not. You know, and I think that's a, you know, a little bit of a warning flag for the incoming administration, because traditionally presidents don't get more popular while they hold the office, absent really extraordinary circumstances. You know, you see a nice, slow, steady decline. And, you know, in a world where, you know, President Trump doesn't have Hillary Clinton to run against, what does he do to prop himself up when he can no longer be the lesser of two evils? That said, I think to your larger question about the incoming administration, there was a Washington Post story over the summer, and I want to say it was Dan Balls, but I can't remember for sure. But they got this background tip from somebody on John Kasich's team, that Trump's team had reached out and said, you know, we'd like you to be the vice president. We'll put you in charge of foreign and domestic policy. And they said, well, what will Trump do? And his team said, he'll be making America great again. So I think really what you see, and I don't know that there's any difference in between this incoming cabinet and one that a president, Mike Pence, would have appointed. You know, I think Cam's right. You see the vice president exerting himself to get a very, what amounts to a very conservative Republican government installed outside of the president himself. You know, and Trump is in some ways atypical Republican and in some ways very atypical. But this is going to be a conservative Republican government. And, you know, I think that's why a lot of Democrats, myself included, are skeptical about how wide the divide between the White House and congressional Republicans is actually going to be. You know, you have an incoming administration that maybe got a late start, but they're here now.
If you're just joining us, we are talking about politics in this year of 2017, we're broadcasting live from the Absolutely Fabulous Studios, NPR's Absolutely Fabulous Studios here in Washington, D.C. My guests are Cam Savage. He's a longtime Republican political strategist. Ben Ray, who is a longtime Democratic political strategist. And Jacob Rund, who is with CQ Roll Call. We are not taking calls during this broadcast, but if you want to join the conversation, please send us an email at nolimits@wfyi.org, find us on Facebook at nolimitswfyi, or track us down on Twitter at WFYI. I'm John Kroll. You're listening to No Limits. Please stay with us. Welcome back to No Limits. I am John Kroll, director of Franklin College's Pulliam School of Journalism, publisher of thestatehousefile.com, and your host. We're talking today about politics in 2017. We're broadcasting live from NPR studios in Washington, D.C. We're talking with Cam Savage, who's a longtime Republican strategist, Ben Ray, who is a longtime Democratic strategist, and Jacob Rund of CQ Roll Call. We're not taking calls during this show, but we are taking emails, and you can find us at nolimits@wfyi.org, or you can find us on Facebook at nolimitswfyi, or on Twitter at WFYI. Got a question from a listener named Jack. Says, given that we have a divided electorate, but have a Congress and President theoretically controlled by the Republican Party, do you expect the Democrats in Congress to oppose proposed legislation because it comes from Donald Trump's administration, or do you expect them to give legislation a hearing? Jacob, I'm going to start with you on that one because, no offense to my two other guests, you really don't have an axe to grind that fight.
Right. Well, I think it can go either way, and it really depends on, you know, what is coming down the pike. I think in some cases, especially like I had mentioned previously, you know, repealing and replacing the Affordable Care Act, I think that's going to be something that will obviously be opposed by most Democrats. You know, President Obama is meeting with congressional Democrats tomorrow on the issue. So that's something that obviously you can expect that will be opposed, and there will be a pretty large fight over that. But, you know, there's some smaller items that may garner the support of Democrats as well. You know, just looking over some things that are coming soon in Congress here, we can expect a repeal of Dodd-Frank, which, you know, a lot of congressional Democrats are not happy about, but there is some wiggle room there. I think there are some specific proposals that have been floated already, some by House Financial Services Chairman Jeb Hensarling, that have got some Democratic backing. So I think there are some small issues that Democrats will give a chance. So it's not going to be everything that comes out of the White House that Democrats will oppose. At least that's not what it's looking at the moment.
Got another email from a listener named Kenny. And again, our email address is nolimits@wfyi.org. Kenny writes, no people of conscience will ever accept the legitimacy of a man who openly brags about his prowess at sexual battery, who is an indicated swindler and charity fraudster, and has finessed his way out of disclosing the most fundamental information every citizen deserves, his taxes. Donald Trump won by significantly losing the popular vote, and the GOP Congress has won the past four election cycles by losing the actual votes cast, but rather by gerrymandered districts. These travesties are an insurmountable barrier to any citizen who has an ethical compass accepting the legitimacy of the government. Go ahead, Cam. I can tell you're leaning in on that one.
I think the First Amendment is a wonderful thing. I actually think Jack's email prior to that is really fascinating. It's the thing that I'm most interested in. It is, how will Democrats deal with Donald Trump? I'm particularly interested in red state Democrats. There are 9 Democrats up for re-election in 2018 who are from states that President-elect Trump carried. These are the most 9 interesting people in politics to me. One of them is our very own Senator Joe Donnelly. And so if you want to know, you know, the likelihood of success for President-elect Trump on really big key issues and appointments and maybe even some judicial appointments, these are the people to watch. Joe Donnelly is a guy to watch on this. And I think on some issues, you know, if I'm running for re-election in 2 years in 2018, you know, obviously the midterms are often problematic for the president's party, particularly when one party is in control. That would generally, you know, lead you to believe that the party out of power would have a pretty good opportunity to hold some seats and win some seats. But if I'm Joe Donnelly, I see that President Trump carried the state, Indiana, by 20 points. That makes me nervous. And so he'll be a very interesting person to watch as we sort of localize this conversation. I'd keep my eyes on Joe Donnelly and how he votes on some of the big ticket items that the president puts forward.
Ben.
Yeah, I think, you know, you look at Democrats and, you know, we're not going to be the Republicans voting down an ADA vote when Bob Dole is brought to the Senate floor to stump for it in his wheelchair because it had bipartisan support in his day and doesn't anymore. But I think you will see Democrats take the opportunity to oppose the president when it's appropriate. Look, everybody wants the cancer moonshot to succeed, right? So on areas where the parties are able to agree, I don't think you're going to see Democrats voting no just to vote no. But when it comes to protecting Medicare, and this incoming administration has a HHS secretary designate that has repeatedly advocated privatizing it. When you see that, when you see this issue with Russia, which is Republicans and Democrats on the opposite side of the issue of the incoming administration, I expect you to see Democrats really stand up for our shared values, for these popular programs, for important initiatives like standing up to Vladimir Putin. I would not count on the president finding a whole lot of common ground if he's going to pursue policies like that.
Jacob, what's a story that isn't getting the sort of attention that it should? I mean, what are you, to the degree that you care to share this, what are you working on right now that you think people should be paying attention to, but because there's so much drama involved in conflict, aren't?
Well, that's a good question. I think actually what I just talked about with the repealing of Dodd-Frank, or the potential repealing of Dodd-Frank, I think that has extremely large implications, and it has the potential to be foreshadowed by some other things that are going on right now. And, you know, it's uncertain when that could happen or when those votes could come down or actually how, you know, a repeal would be packaged and come into play. But, you know, depending on when that comes down, that could, you know, fly under the radar a little bit, but it still has implications for the financial industry. It could, you know, loosen some regulations on banks and things of that nature. So, I think that's one of the things to keep an eye on. As, like I said, depending on what happens, it could, you know, not get as much attention as maybe some people think it deserves.
So we've talked about Mike Pence's role, and ultimately we should localize this even more because, as Jacob pointed out at the top, I think it's the first time in a quarter of a century Indiana's had a member who is part of the federal executive branch. What do we expect his role to be? And, you know, what strengths is he going to bring to the table? What weaknesses is he going to bring along with him as well? I'll tell you what, I suspect Cam will be more comfortable talking about the strengths and Ben will be more comfortable talking about the weaknesses. So we'll start with the strengths.
Well, sure. I mean, I think I've said this before publicly. I think in many ways, Governor Pence was born to be vice president. He gives a great speech. He's an excellent cheerleader. He'll go around the country tirelessly. The guy will do great at a funeral. You need to send him to Asia for a funeral. He's going to represent America well. Interestingly, in this particular government dynamic, he also is going to have some very, very real responsibilities. As I said earlier, I expect him to be one of the most influential vice presidents in my lifetime. And what we're seeing already is that he is filling two key roles right now. He is the de facto liaison to Congress. There will be an official Trump, you know, congressional liaison at some point. But this is a job that basically, you know, Mike Pence is doing right now and is likely to continue to do. And he's also working as head of the transition. And he's essentially staffing the government with all the key jobs below the level of secretary. These are essentially the people that run the government on a day-to-day basis. Those two things are going to make him very influential. He is fundamentally a person who is liked and respected. He's a pretty good listener. And so what you'll see is he will be able to be successful, I think, in both of those roles because he can not just bring people together, but I think he'll be open to taking a lot of advice and counsel when it comes to filling the government and also working on legislation. So he is, you know, I think his greatest strength, and we saw this as governor, was that he's likable. And there were times that the Indiana General Assembly, I mean, after 8 years of Mitch Daniels, the General Assembly was tired of getting pushed around. I think they would tell you this, and they took it upon themselves.
Yeah, they would. Yeah. They took it
upon themselves to re-exert some authority when Governor Pence came in. You know, the legislature starts 3 weeks ahead of the governor. They got a head start. They took off running, and there's no question about that. There were times during his time as governor when the legislature gave him things, pieces of his agenda, that they were not inclined to do, that I believe they did mostly because they liked him. Okay? If we see that same sort of thing, relationship with the House and the Senate, I think it'll be a very good thing for the American people, and certainly a very good thing for the Trump administration. In some ways, it's his greatest asset that he is a likable guy.
Ben?
You know, I think Cam's, you know, Cam's right about the role that we can expect to see a Vice President Pence play. You know, I think that this is something that, you know, we don't even have to look past the present administration to see something similar. You know, Joe Biden is regularly doing the tough outreach to Congress on behalf of the Obama White House. Now, what I do think is different is that, you know, I'm a little more skeptical that he'll be able to succeed. And I think there's a couple of fundamental issues here. You know, one is that when you look at Pence's track record as governor in Indiana, you know, it's not stellar. You know, you obviously had the problem with RFRA. The economic fallout from that was staggering. You know, I think you look at some of his other, you know, missteps, whether or not, I'm sure Cam would say this is unfair, but whether or not it's fair, the bit about, oh, we're going to have a state-run media outlet. He's not, if I had to pick one guy in the Republican Party to have that role, I wouldn't pick him. But I don't want to be totally negative here. So what I hope that he spends part of his time on is advocating for journalists. You know, and I think you saw him do this in the campaign with some success when he talked about how he was going to work to address the outlets that had been blacklisted by the Trump campaign. You know, I think you're going to continue to see a hostile relationship between the White House and its press corps. And I hope that he works to mitigate that. I hope he works to make sure that we've got an open government that, you know, citizens and journalists alike are able to verify as being run in a responsible and ethical fashion.
Jacob, how much of that, I mean, there is a part of Mike Pence's role that I haven't seen with another vice president. And to some degree, it is, Cam and Ben both alluded to this, but a large part of his job is going to be translating Donald Trump to traditional power bases such as Congress, the Republicans there, and media, journalists, that kind of diplomatic work, and also translating those bases and their priorities back to the president. How well suited, you covered him in Indiana too,
yes.
How well suited do you think he is to performing that role? Because that strikes me, I mean, you know, other than bringing peace to the Middle East, that might be one of the most difficult jobs around.
Right. Well, I think that'll be interesting to watch. It's not necessarily something that he had to do when he was governor. Mm-hmm. You know, he had people maybe who had to translate for him. He was the top guy. Now he's translating for somebody else. So that's going to be interesting to watch. But I think really he, like you said, and like Cam said, you know, he's going to be that de facto liaison to Congress. He kind of did that during the campaign as well. He had to tone down some of the rhetoric that Trump was using, and he appears to be effective at that. If you'll remember back when some of the tapes came out during the campaign, when, you know, of Trump saying some lewd things towards women, a lot of people in Congress were calling for Trump to, or for, excuse me, Pence to take over the ticket. So Pence is extremely well liked in Congress. You know, he spent six terms there. He was the chairman of the Republican Study Committee and the Republican Conference chairman. You know, he's friends with Paul Ryan and a lot of members. And so I think if they're going to listen to anybody, it'll probably be him.
We've got just a few minutes left here, and I'm going to synthesize several emails, Facebook questions we've got, all of which deal with the Affordable Care Act. What, you know, I'm going to ask you to put on your crystal ball here. We know it's going to change in some fashion. What is going to emerge from this, if you can predict it? I'm going to give you each about 30 seconds on it so we don't run out of time. I'll start with Jacob first.
Well, it's it's hard to predict, I'll say that. I think right now there's a battle going on between, you know, whether it needs to happen immediately or whether it needs to happen over a long period of time, and that's a repeal and replacement of Obamacare. That's kind of the big battle going on with among Republicans right now, and so that's going to be something to watch moving forward.
Cam, what do you think?
Yeah, I think one of the underwritten stories of the last campaign was the effect of rising premiums that were hitting people's mailboxes in September and October had on the election. I think there'll be incredible pressure for the president-elect to move quickly, and I think that probably means a full repeal and replace. I think anything less than that is going to be a real problem with his base.
Ben?
I think it's clear the Republican Party doesn't know what they're going to replace the Affordable Care Act with. And I think that's going to be the single biggest hurdle from them. I think you're going to see a lot of jockeying. I think you're going to see some attempts to, you know, get Cam's nine most interesting people in Washington, those Democratic senators in Trump states.
We're not
to
likely
play
to be lonely over the next few years.
It's going to be an interesting time. But I still don't see anything in the Republican Party that says that they're able to fix this in a responsible manner. I think they're going to continue to try and play politics with it, and I hope that they don't hurt people along the way.
Well, I think I'd like to thank all three of my guests. Cam Savage, who is a veteran Republican political strategist. Ben, thank you very much for joining us, longtime Democratic political strategist, and Jacob Rund, who is with CQ Roll Call. I'd also like to thank all of the other folks who helped make this show possible, Emily Dagger and her superb crew here at NPR's studios in Washington, D.C., Shannon Cagle and Joe Hatcher and our superb crew back in Indianapolis, Jim Simmons and Shelby Mullis, who did great work here in D.C. with us. Also like to invite everyone to come back on Thursday when we're going to be broadcasting again from these studios, and we're going to be interviewing longtime Indiana U.S. Senator Richard Lugar. We hope you will join us. I am John Kroll. You have been listening to No Limits. Thank you for joining us.
No Limits is a production of 90.1 WFYI Public Radio, Indianapolis. Executive producer, Michelle Johnson. Producer, Shannon Cagle. Interactive media coordinator, Scott McAllister. Technical producers, Cedric Freeman and Chris Flood. And board engineer, Joe Hatcher. Abby Cherzini screens our calls. No Limits is made available through IPBS, Indiana's public broadcasting stations.